Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We are coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Marlene Even. The Australian government announced their fourth federal budget this week. As journalists pored over the many, many pages in the budget lockup, it wasn't a surprise in a pre-election budget that there would be a cash splash. Today, we focus on the media coverage of federal budgets. Is the media actually making the budget into a giant monster, gobbling up all our attention for weeks on end, when budgets are in reality austere and largely boring documents? Through the prism of winners and losers, a cash splash here and a budget cut there, how do journalists get through the fine print and present the budget? To discuss this and more, we are joined by two journalists, Kishore Napier-Raman, federal politics reporter at Crikey, and Michael Rodan, national correspondent at the Australian Financial Review. Welcome both back to Fourth Estate.
Hey, how's it going?
Good to be here.
So the budget lockup is a unique event where journalists are stuck in a room for 6 hours without any internet to go over the budget papers. If we put the actual content of the budget aside for a moment, what is that actual experience like to report in that way?
Look, 6 hours without my phone is really difficult. but you know, jokes aside, not being able to kind of, you know, have internet and that kind of thing does make it a little bit more difficult. I think on the other hand, you know, if you didn't have maybe that ritual of being in the lockup for 6 hours before, you'd lose two things. I think firstly, maybe the budget wouldn't be seen as quite as important by some media as it already is. I think that whole sense of ritual kind of elevates it a little bit. But I think the other thing on the flip side of that is maybe you won't get the kind of depth in terms of coverage. I think when you've got 6 hours to stare at the budget papers and literally not do anything else because you're locked in a room, you can sort of dig into the weeds a lot more than people might if they were not in that room and, you know, having to cover other things and whatever, if that makes sense.
It certainly does. Is that the same experience for you, Michael?
Yeah, sort of. Look, Kishore's not wrong. But the entire process is sort of like a ridiculous anachronism in the internet age. Basically, like it's unfathomable to think that if on any other normal day, the government could lock up, you know, hundreds of journalists in one room, take away all their devices and give them like a stack of documents that are made by the government without being able to go outside and talk to anyone else about what's in them. And then that's all you get to do for the day is you just have to do this. It's crazy because the government sort of set this thing up as a way to sort of massage the message that it's giving to everyone. And the budget, you know, in years gone by was quite a big deal. You know, the ratings on television were much more. Laurie Oakes would, you know, get the scoop and have the first interview afterwards. But now it's a bit more rigmarole. There's dribs and drabs of the budget announcements that are leaked out beforehand. We basically knew everything that was in the documents this time before we went in. And then once you're in there, you just have to sort of, it's almost like dictation, you know, that there's some interesting detail throughout the books, which probably go to the length of a few hundred pages. But in reality, if all the announcements have been made beforehand, the documents are really just sort of an amalgamation of forecasts that may not ever come to fruition and a couple of speeches where the government dictates to the journalists that it's doing amazing things, you know, and they're also, they're political documents in a sense, but the entire sort of apparatus of the budget day is just, it's just another way for the politicians to sort of control the message. The good thing about this time was that the ratings were pretty dismal. I think everyone's sort of tuned out of it, so the longer it goes on, I guess the more people lose interest in it.
Yeah, shocking. People are more interested in watching maths than Josh's speech last the other night.
You kind of mentioned there, Michael, that the lockup had this purpose of not leaking information to influence markets, and that was the purpose of the lockup. Now that we have information already announced ahead by the government and markets are becoming much more sophisticated and complex, does it make sense to have the lockup now? Is it just a bit of theatre?
Well, a couple of years ago, the government put a $6 billion tax on the banks called the major bank levy. And that was, you know, an actual market sensitive thing. If word got out about that, it would cause stock prices to fall. Which is what happened, because there was a leak on Sky News the night before, and during the day the bank shares started panicking, and then the Financial Review followed up on it because someone got information out somehow. They did a big sort of investigation that came to naught because it probably came from a senior Treasury official or something like that. I also had a couple of years ago had a little budget scoop that was deemed market sensitive, although in retrospect, I don't think it was. But when I was going around trying to confirm it ahead of time, you know, I'd call up official contacts and everything like that, and they were just like, we cannot talk to you about this, you know. And so they take it pretty seriously. In that respect, there does need to be some sort of limit on the information that comes out. But in terms of, you know, in today's age, you don't need 7 hours to lock journalists up to not be able to talk to their contacts or to get outside advice on things. You just upload it to the internet and everyone gets it at the same time and they can go through it. So when a company announces something that's market sensitive to the Australian Stock Exchange, they don't lock it up and give it to people ahead of time. They just say, here it is, and it's now public, so everyone has equal access to it and equal opportunity. And you know, it might be that the computers can read these documents faster than, you know, financial traders can, and, you know, high frequency trading can do this and that. But generally, it's like these things aren't big enough to move the dial on anything. Cynically, I'd have to say that it's just a matter of the government wanting to have the focus entirely on itself to the exclusion of all other critical voices.
Do you agree, Kishore?
Obviously, the whole budget circus is very much about the government controlling the messaging. And look, the purpose of the lockup does seem to kind of, you know, fall away when this was, like Michael sort of hinted at, an utterly predictable budget. I mean, we knew it was going to be a kind of pre-election cash splash. A lot of the things that made it so were kind of teased and eventually dropped into the media in the days, weeks before. So like, you know, all that kind of headline stuff is already really out there. You kind of have a sense of what the narrative is going to be like, at least, you know, this one. So yeah, there does seem to be an element of futility in sitting through that 6-hour lockup sometimes. It is about the government controlling messaging, controlling the narrative and that kind of thing. But I think even then, what was interesting, it was sort of in the coverage that followed on Tuesday night and on, you know, despite what the government was so desperate to do in sort of making this budget look big and generous and that kind of thing, I think there was a fair bit of understandable criticism at sort of how cynical the whole purpose of this budget was, that a lot of people were calling it out as a cash splash. I saw the word bribe used in a lot of the coverage as well. So I don't know, it felt like maybe they'd been so obvious in telegraphing what this was about that it kind of opened the government up to a fair bit of critical coverage. But then again, you know, when no one's actually watching the budget play out on TV that night and that kind of thing, I wonder how much of that kind of critical coverage is actually going to filter through to the regular punter and what messaging people are actually going to take away from the budget itself and whether that actually changes any votes and so on and so on.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like Kishore says, the whole thing was sort of just like this gift-wrapped sort of pre-election splash. And the rating, there was a good story by Samantha Maiden that looked at the ratings of the night, and usually the Treasurer's speech at 7:30 is the big one. That rated 12th of its time slot, way behind Maths and behind a show on Channel 10 about you know, rescue dogs or something like that. What was interesting was that the government actually dropped at 6 p.m. News that it was going to give out in the budget. So this is before the journalists are out and they can talk about what's in it. So before anyone was out, the government dropped this story to all of the commercial stations that everyone was going to get, you know, the $420 or the $250 if you're a pensioner payment. And so they did that so it would make the 6 p.m. news bulletins, which have about double the viewership that the 7:30 speech got. So it's like the whole thing's just sort of falling apart, and we're seeing the politicians react differently to it because they know they can't compete with Married at First Sight or Rescue Dogs on Channel 10.
And I guess the other point there as well is, you know, if the budget is about sort of, you know, media control, it's very much about media control and a kind of outdated view about how people are internalizing news. Like the days of people sitting down and watching terrestrial TV or news bulletins are really kind of like, you know, I mean, maybe some people are, but a lot of people aren't anymore. And especially among younger viewers, although I'm not sure how much the government cares about younger voters, but, you know, especially among younger viewers, a lot of people aren't doing that, not consuming news and information in the same way. So the idea of this like 7:30 ritual, everyone sits down at the TV to watch the treasurer's speech, I don't know, it seems like something from the 90s. I don't know if that's going to change anytime soon, but certainly a lot of the incentives and the reasoning behind presenting it in that way seem to be, you know, related to a reality in terms of news viewership that doesn't really exist anymore.
It's an interesting point to talk about how we're presenting it with getting attention in like that nightly bulletin. It's fair to say that a lot of people tune into the budget coverage primarily to see how it's going to affect them. And then I suppose looking at issues that are important to them, which cues the who are the winners and losers of this budget article. I want to ask you both, what is the impact of presenting the budget through this winners and losers lens?
If I want to go first, then I guess, you know, it's obviously problematic because it sets up sort of, even when there's sort of good policy, you know, there's always going to be losers because the budget sort of, it's not a zero-sum thing, but basically there has to be someone paying money if there's money going out the other end. And so I do think that it is quite reductive in one sense, but then again, it's, you know, we're trying to get the public to be interested in this incredibly boring document, so telling them what they might get out of it is one way that people actually do connect, and, you know, they might read further, and, you know, so on and so forth. The problem, I guess, on framing it like that, I think it works both ways, is because it does sort of cause haywire for when you actually need to do good things. That there was some tax changes made in the 2016 budget that affected people with superannuation savings over $3.2 million if you were a couple. And it was such a small change, but it just led to sort of months and months and months in coverage. And, you know, apparently even sort of hampered Turnbull's re-election prospects in that election. And that's sort of bad when you're going around telling, you know, rich retirees that they're losers, even if they're extremely comfy and whatnot. But then, you know, like this year, there was nothing in the coverage. And I was looking at like a couple of like the winners and losers sort of tables that were in various things. And, you know, it was like in one of them, like there was just nothing to go on this year. It was such a nothing budget. But one of the tables was like, who are the losers? Electric vehicles are losers. And I was like, I didn't know that they were like, do electric vehicles pay tax? Not at all. You know, it's like, I don't know. So I think it's sort of like, it's a meme that sort of jumped the shark by now, because it's just, you know, it's just beyond its use, I guess.
Yeah, I think we certainly had sort of discussions about whether to do it at all. I mean, there's often an element of, well, everyone's doing it, it's a sort of box tick budget story that you just kind of do. I do think sometimes like actually looking for losers itself is rather than winners necessarily is an interesting way of attacking a budget, particularly, you know, one like this, obviously really trying to be as generous as possible and win as many votes as possible. You know, trying to find which sort of smaller areas didn't go as well as they could have, like, you know, higher education wasn't great for them, hasn't been for the last couple of years. But even then, the losers were few and far between. Look, I think it can be reductive. And like Michael said, though, if the point is like trying to communicate what's in the budget papers. Most regular folk aren't going to be reading the budget papers. Those kind of graphics that you can have with winners and losers are kind of just a good way to get engagement. And you can see the attraction for a news organization to sort of fall back on that as a way of communicating things.
Yeah, and you think about the 2014 budget, Tony Abbott's first one with Joe Hockey. It was like the loser list on that thing was longer than a roll of toilet paper. It was everyone. It energized the whole sort of mood of the electorate against that government. And Tony Abbott never got clear air again after that. And some of it went to $100,000 degrees, putting dole bludgers on, cutting them off after 6 months, things like that. And it just, it lit a fire under, all these sort of like activism groups and unions and whatnot. And so in that way, it probably, reporting it in terms of winners and losers like that is probably helpful in giving the public a sense of the overall political feel of the document. And after all, it's a political thing, it has to pass parliament. If too many people are losers, then they're going to tell their elected representatives not to pass it, and they won't. So it's not a budget after all,
Well, that's the other point. A lot of those losers might not actually lose out if the stuff in it doesn't get through. And, if it's too antagonistic, like a lot of that Abbott budget was, then, it's going to struggle.
I think the 2014 budget is a really interesting example. The overall response the next morning wasn't actually very negative at all. But then Ross Giddens, for instance, gave it a high grade. Later, he reversed his position. It took over a week for the full story to break. And in the end, it became an incredibly toxic one for the government. Was 2014 an outlier, or has the media learnt some lessons from that budget? Michael, I'll go to you.
It's an interesting question. I think that the 2014 budget was the last time the government ever tried to do anything sort of that resembled inverted commas reform. It was a really ambitious sort of document, and I think it came off the back of that commission of audit that Tony did when he first came in. Since then, I think everyone's got pretty scared of policies that might leave the electorate a bit unnerved. The interesting thing is like it might have taken a couple of days or a week for it to really sort of like crystallize in people's minds. But on budget night, the first interview that Joe Hockey went along to as treasurer that evening was Laurie Oakes. And the first question Laurie Oakes asked him was, why were you caught dancing in your office to the Best Day of My Life with your son when you're cutting this, you're cutting that, and you're putting welfare recipients, you're cutting them off after 6 months. And it's just like, it was just this perfect sort of like snapshot of the electorate's mood of this budget, and they never recovered from it. And so it's like, we can sit around gagging about how budget coverage is becoming increasingly meaningless, but sometimes those little moments do just sort of set the tone for the rest of the year,
Yeah, look, I was in first year uni when that budget was handed down, so I can't say I was paying quite so much attention to like media coverage as I would be now. That said, I think Mike's a good point there, which is that that was the last time really you got a budget that was, without obviously like necessarily endorsing what the Abbott was trying to do, just like quite bold and big in terms of what it was putting out there. Ever since then, all the ones I've covered have just been really, really predictable, I want to say. Like just, you kind of have known exactly what you're going to get. A lot of it's been dropped. It's just so tethered to kind of what the political, and obviously all budgets are, but what the immediate political program of the government is at the time. I do think the response to that Abbott budget really has sort of made governments a bit wary about how much they're going to give away and how I think ideological they're going to make the budget. So look, it'll be interesting as well on that note to see. That was obviously the first budget after a change of government, after two terms of Labor. Labor have said that they wanted do another budget later this year if they get re-elected, which I really hope they don't, because I've had to do three.
Leave us alone.
Just like, just wait a little bit. But it'll be interesting to see what they do in that budget, whether they do signal a big transformation of the country when, everything they've done before leading up to the election suggests they want to play it really safe. And again, how the media does choose to cover that budget and how they tackle a change in government. So, if that comes about, it'll be an interesting time.
Okay, I have a scenario for you both. You two have just been made editors. When it comes to budget analysis, what would you like to see covered in the media that doesn't receive as much attention? Kishore, I'll go to you first.
God, who would make me an editor? It's crazy.
Yeah, no, I'm also not an editor.
But look, if they did, I would hope that the analysis dug a little bit further than the Treasurer's speech. Obviously, the speech is the big thing that signals where the government is going, but I would want maybe more coverage that really delved into specialist topic areas. And I think that's maybe a problem that you sometimes have in the media itself, just by virtue of the industry shrinking over the last couple of years and whatnot. You don't have a heap of specialist knowledge in certain areas. I'd like a lot of that kind of thing. So, you have someone who's really cluey on climate, doing the climate coverage, the same with defense. And, you have that a little bit, but I'd like to see more of that and look at it through the prism of those kind of areas.
If I was editor, which I don't want to be, I would opt to, I would willingly lose my job by not covering the budget, or I just send, one or two people and run it on the inside of, down page 16 or something like that. I think that it plays too much into the government's hands. And if they aren't going to take these documents seriously, which they increasingly don't, I don't think it's worth just giving them a huge amount of, you look at the coverage of the papers, it's the Treasurer Josh Frydenberg on the front of everything. The wraparound is, 16 pages sometimes. It's increasingly boring, and it's messaging by the government. And because the only things you can quote from are these speeches that are handed to you with the name of the minister on the top. More and more, it's just, I don't want to, if I was editor, I wouldn't want to run sort of like a Pravda operation. I don't think that the way that we cover these budgets is suitable for the really overtly political documents that they become.
Add to that briefly, to the extent that there is interesting stuff in it, there is plenty interesting in the budget papers in spite of, what they are trying to do with them. But, a lot of that stuff is the kind of minutiae and the fine print that only comes through a lot of, digging in parts that no one's really looking at. And that stuff is interesting, maybe to me it's interesting. But also, I think it's often more interesting than the stuff that really leads the coverage, which is, just like Michael says, quite almost verbatim, just quoting the Treasurer's speech, putting out what they want you to put out, what all the generous handouts are going to look like and that kind of thing. So, there's a lot in there. So I wouldn't necessarily avoid covering it completely, but, I think there's just got to be a little bit of, maybe specialization, how the coverage looks and maybe just a bit of awareness of what the point of this whole circus is.
And going on from that, when you're talking about, holding account beyond just the speeches or the media releases, the federal budget reflects what the government's plan is. It puts their full values on display. What role do you think journalists have to connect the dots between what the government says they'll do versus what they actually do in terms of the budget?
Yeah, it's with this one, it's shown that the government's plan is to get re-elected. There's just nothing really beyond that. There's no thought beyond that. There's no real policy or even ideology, despite this being a conservative government, beyond that. And they've kind of shown that, a lot over the last term, especially the last year, that really is their kind of the start and end point of what they're about. It's tough because, as journalists, there's this both sides is in the profession. There's this desire to sort of sit in the middle and not editorialize too much. And I think while, you know, maintaining that stance of objectivity, while also bringing critical analysis to a budget and to something that is primarily about government spin, is always like a kind of slightly difficult tightrope for people to walk. That said, I've actually thought, you know, a lot of the coverage this year, I think I flagged this earlier, has actually been pretty good to the extent that it has sort of been fairly blunt in calling out this budget for what it is, which is primarily just a thing designed to like fix up some short-term political problems, make the government that has been struggling in the polls for a while look as palatable and as generous as possible and just get them re-elected. And then it's like, I don't even know what the hell happens after that. They don't really seem to know what's happening after that. So look, I think the media has been decent at connecting the dots. It'll be interesting to see how they cover a hypothetical fourth coalition term under Morrison, because I don't really know what they're going to do. They don't really seem to know what they're going to do either.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because, you know, when you open up the documents and it says, we're doing this, you know, I think the government also knows at this point as well is that, you know, they've got a hostile Senate and they have for you know, God knows how long now. Whatever they say that they're planning to do, it's always, you know, a great deal of horse trading to get anything through the Senate at the moment. And you look at the legislative record of not just the Morrison, but the Turnbull and the Tony government, it's very thin. And I think that part of the reason probably why they haven't opted to do very much is because they know that they can't really get anything through there. On the fiscal side of things, you know, the budgets are funny in that, you know, we put so much effort into covering what Treasury's forecasting for wages, inflation, deficit, yada yada. None of that ever sticks. You know, it's like no one knows what's going to happen next week, let alone next month or in a year's time. You know, the government printed the back in black mugs before it unveiled, I think, the biggest deficit in history because of COVID. So, you know, there's only so much credit you can put in towards a forward-looking document, because, you know, the past is unknowable, but the future is, you know, twice as.
That's a good point. And I don't think we really heard much about, you know, the budget deficit or surplus as we have in previous budgets. Would you attribute that to a pre-election budget? Like, do we care about deficit spending anymore? Should we?
Well, the budget debt is set to peak in 2026. I don't know, for well over $1 trillion. And that's enormous, considering that in 2009 or 10, Rudd was like crucified for having $40 billion in the red during the GFC. I think it's a function that the Liberals are in power, and if Labor is in power next budget, they'll probably make a song and dance about how much debt and deficit we have on the books. The other side of it is that borrowing costs for the government, you know, on our debt and interest repayments are lower than they have been historically, thanks to low interest rates. That could change for the moment, but right now, you know, debt doesn't matter because it's cheap to service. It'll change obviously once interest rates go up globally. But even, you know, even saying that is like a prediction that might not come to fruition, because the world economy is going to be in the crapper soon because we can't grow wheat in the Ukraine or buy it from Russia. So who knows what's going to happen? You know, maybe debt will be twice as big. But yeah, I think people, we had like a love affair with talking about debt and deficit during the Rudd-Gillard years, but, you know, it was all conveniently forgotten when the coalition government came to power. We decided that no big problem.
Yeah. There's a hypothetical world which Bill Shorten won the last election and the pandemic hits and they don't do any of this, you know, JobKeeper or any of the big spending stuff because they're so terrified of, you know, what happened after the GFC and that whole narrative of Labor being reckless at spending and the debt and deficit that was so effectively used by Tony Abbott as well, as opposition leader. So And I think that effectiveness of that sort of Labor being bad with money debt meme, it, you know, shows that I think the things that become political talking points do change. I mean, obviously the fact that Labor have sort of tried to talk about the government and their record debt, obviously they don't talk about it too much and it hasn't really stuck as a kind of line of attack. So yeah, look, I wonder how much people are kind of plugged into it. There was certainly a point in our political history where that was quite a kind of potent line of attack, you know, for an opposition politician. But yeah, like Michael says, I think that there is maybe a kind of acknowledgement in some of the chatter around the budget, in some of the discourse around the economy, that we are living through a particularly volatile time right now. So yeah, I do wonder again how and you know, stuff like debt will be politicized if Albanese wins the election, and if Labor are now the government with all that big deficit, again remains to be seen. We can, and again, you know, if it happens, you can cry all day about like the hypocrisy of coverage, the hypocrisy of like what becomes a political attack line. But I guess that's just kind of the reality of the world we live in sometimes, that the things are going to be run, like that those kinds of attacks are going to be run. And, you know, if a party can't deal with them and withstand them and have an effective response to them, then they're just not doing a very good job, maybe.
And we are expecting the government to call the election any day now. Do either of you think the budget will make much impact or even be talked about in a week's time?
I mean, I think the idea of a budget bounce is sometimes overhyped a little bit. You know, the people that follow the budget closely are like the same people that watch Insiders on Sunday for fun, which is a class of people that already knows exactly who they're going to vote for and are probably not the kind of people that will decide this election and the kind of people that the Morrison government is really pitching to get re-elected.
I think people are just switched out, zonked out, don't care. You know, it's like we've had like the worst 2.5 years in living memory, and people just don't care about the politics. They've made up their mind about Scott Morrison, I think. That's for sure. And I don't think that anything is going to change their mind from where they are at the moment. You know, like they might pull out some little spending things, you know, chuck a road there, a bridge over here, some rail over there. But I think that people have made up their mind about this government. And normally before they do the whole lockup shenanigans, the treasurer and the prime minister sit down for a little photo opportunity and they sort of flick through the budget papers together and they go, oh, isn't that interesting? Look at this line over here. And they take a few pictures for the news. This year, it was Frydenberg and the finance minister, Simon Birmingham. And where was ScoMo? You know, was he having a cigar out the back? Who knows? But yeah, obviously, like I think they know that he's a bit on the nose. So
this is, I guess, it's Josh's big week as well. You know, I think, and it's a big week as well for him to kind of maybe furnish up his credentials as the next leader of the Liberal Party. Should Morrison go down in May? But yeah, I just don't know if ordinary folk, whatever necessarily, you know, sorry, ordinary folk, people that aren't like really, really clued in, plugged in politics watchers, were ever paying a huge amount of attention to a budget such that it would swing their vote and swing their vote as well in a matter of like a month. If the Morrison government clings on to power, I don't think it's going to be because of the budget itself. I think it will probably be, you know, obviously a bunch of factors, but, you know, they'll probably manage to convince enough people that in a kind of slightly uncertain time, it's worth holding their nose and sticking with the devil they know. Even if Morrison himself, I think people just kind of like don't seem to like him that much at the moment.
I suppose we will have to wait and see. Thank you both so much for taking the time to join and bring your insight.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
On that note, I'd like to thank Michael Roden and Kishore Napier Rahman for being on Fourth Estate. And thanks for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media, politics, and a lot in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU. Thanks to our executive producer, Anthony Dockrell. I'm Marlene Even. Thanks for listening.